This is the Big Sky Boneheads podcast, our latest episode dropping here mid-February as we look at the snow flying, but we're thinking about nicer weather. My name's Michael Gray. His name is Scott Hershey. Please subscribe and rate, review, five-star the show, unless you have a low opinion of it, in which case lie, and then five-star the show anyway, wherever it is.
Who has a low opinion? Nobody. It's wonderful.
I think that's just my own self-esteem being reflected in my thoughts. We are watching the snow fly here in Montana, but that is not true everywhere. And we got a special guest today, Helena-born Brian Knight. Man, graduated from Capital High School right here in Montana and is a major league umpire. Has been. He made his debut in 2001. Mm-hmm. He's worked All-Star Games. He's worked the World Series. And I imagine he gets to now get ready for spring training in a place that probably has palm trees.
And what an amazing perspective, because, you know, if you've ever played baseball, if you've ever played sports, you kind of at least understand a little tiny bit about the perspective of playing a sport and about a professional athlete. I don't have any perspective on being a major league umpire. I mean, imagine that you get to go out into that atmosphere. You're in some of the coolest stadiums in the world. You're in front of crowds that are passionate baseball fans, and you get to interact with some of the greatest athletes on the planet and then have them yell at you.
Yeah. Like, that's just it. As an ump, you only have two lanes. You are either hated and despised or completely unnoticed.
Yeah, and that's better.
Yeah, it's best to be invisible if you are, in fact, a major league umpire. As we get ready for another baseball season and we're thinking thoughts that aren't related to the snow, we are joined now by Brian Knight. Brian, where exactly are you right now, bud?
I split time between Northern California and the Sacramento area, and we have a place up in Lake Tahoe on the Nevada side, and so we spend time in both places. I'm a Nevada resident. I get a little bit of the mountains and the skiing still, but I also get to play 18 holes of golf tomorrow if I want. So kind of a good place to be. And my wife's family is in this area. So with me being on the road 7 months a year, it made sense for us to be closer to her family. I did it the opposite as a lot of people are doing now, you know, coming from Montana out here, yeah, as opposed to what you guys are getting up there.
Yeah. I'm glad we could return serve and send at least one of ours like, ha, take that, California.
It's really funny because one of my buddies, one of my golf buddies down here has a place in the Yellowstone Club, and he had some of his buddies from the Yellowstone Club down 2 weeks ago to play golf. And I told him this might be the first time they've ever met a native Montanan.
That's true.
Now, anyways, Brian, yeah, I'm representing out here still. So
I like it.
I think we all we all know that if you're a baseball fan, that spring training's coming up in, so I don't know how many weeks. True baseball fans know it down to the day.
Pitchers and catchers are already reported, right?
Are they really?
I'm asking. Brian, you got to know more about this than I do, bud.
Oh, trying not to think about it quite yet. It feels like I just got home. So
when do the umpires start doing, training? When do you start thinking about the game? When do you start? Is it when you report to spring training as well? How does that work for an umpire? I don't think many fans are familiar with that.
Yeah, so our spring training as major league umpires is we actually just go down and work the games. I'll be leaving here on, on February 23rd. I do my spring training in Fort Myers, Florida, which is my choice. Many, many years in Arizona, and I went back to Florida in 2021. So my first game is on the 25th. I'll get in on the 23rd, get kind of acclimated to the weather and the conditions and get settled in. And then I'll work 13 games in 21 days in the Fort Myers area. And then I actually come back home, you know, about a week and a half off. And then I'm working the very end of spring training. The A's and the Giants play exhibition games, one in Oakland, one in San Francisco. And I'll work those two games to finish off my spring training. And I like doing those games because I like, as the regular season approaches, I like being in a major league stadium, working at night, kind of get used to what that's like. Because in spring training, you know, you're working at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, basically minor league fields, right? So I like having those two games at the end of spring training to kind of get used to, this is what this looks like under the lights again, because in 3 days I'm going to have to go to opening day. And, you know, it's a different story once that starts. So.
And I'm just assuming that to also get ready for the season, that you're just cutting people off in traffic. So they'll yell at you and you'll get a little bit used to that. Does that happen as well?
Yeah. I go around just kind of bugging people just to get a reaction. Sure. When I'm playing golf with my buddies, they give me plenty of grief. So I get a little practice there. So, or I'll forget to do a chore or two around the house and let the wife go after me. And, you know, that gets me ready. Yeah.
Well, you know, and Brian, it's interesting because there are a couple of connections here in Helena to Major League Baseball. I've come to know Goose Gregson a little bit, who's still doing some work with the Red Sox, and he had to leave town. I see him at the gym every now and again. You bring up a great point that people may miss. The amount of travel that you have to do for such an amazing length of time. You know, I was at an ESPN affiliate for the Mariners for a couple of years and got to know those guys real well. The travel that goes into a baseball season is grueling. How do you maintain any kind of balance with family and everything when, to your point, you just said you're gone 7 months out of the year, which is well more than half?
Well, I'm entering my 30th professional season, and I'm hoping to figure it out this year, maybe, how to keep the balance. No, it's a really, really long, grueling schedule. I get really jealous of the NFL officials who work 16 games. And we work 16 games in 16 days. You know, you got to kind of look at the schedule and break it down into parts. Like, I know I'm going to be on the road for 3 weeks, and then I'll get a chance to come home for a couple days. I'm going to be in X, Y, and Z city, so I can plan to do X, Y, and Z while I'm in those cities with people I may know there, and kind of compartmentalize everything. Because if you look at your schedule and see 100, I think we work between 120 and 130 games. If you just look at that and the vast number of travel days involved in that, it'll drive you crazy. So try to go a week at a time, and it's kind of fun. I know that sounds strange, but you make it fun, I guess, in a way.
And then you look
at your airline miles and your hotel points, and that becomes like another game. Like,
oh boy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I have so many Hyatt nights now that I can take my wife on vacation in the off season. And so you kind of start thinking about it in terms of those kind of things.
So those logistics are all up to you as opposed to a team where the team, you know, your player on a team, you just get on the plane. I mean, it's a crazy thought to think that you have to go through the hotel and the flights and all of that.
Yeah. I always laugh when I hear players complain about their travel. I mean, in 2020, during the COVID season, we actually traveled with the teams. I worked on the West Coast, so I was flying with the Padres, with the Rangers, the Astros, the Angels. So I know how difficult their travel is, and I just don't want to hear it anymore. You know what I mean? Because that was an amazing experience. You get done with the game, they say, okay, an hour to the bus. You get on the bus, they hand you a bag of Chick-fil-A on the way onto the bus. They drive you right up to the plane. You walk up the stairs. You're on the plane. Here they come with more food, land right to the hotel. Hotel room keys are ready. Go right to your room. They bring your luggage. For us, it's okay. I'm going to get my schedule here in a couple of weeks. The first thing I'm going to do is open up my Hyatt and Marriott apps and start booking rooms. And then luckily we have a travel agency that Major League Baseball uses. We all kind of have our own dedicated person that we can talk to. She's so good that she'll go through most of the schedule, and she knows what kind of flights I like. She knows when I'm going to be able to come home for a night, and she just starts booking them. And then I'll look at them and get in touch with her and adjust anything that needs to be adjusted. So that's pretty easy. So we're lucky to have that. But yeah, logistically, we're pretty good at all that stuff. I mean, I always said I could open a travel agency when I'm done with this job and help people out. It's pretty amazing what we are able to accomplish in a short period of time, because we'll get our schedule 6 weeks before opening day. I mean, I have 7 months of travel ahead of me. I have no idea where I'm going to be yet.
Wow. And yeah. Brian, I'm assuming this all must have started with a deep love for the game of baseball, but everything you just described sounds like a great way to suck all of the fun out of the game of baseball.
When you're in the middle of those 7 week runs between being home, or you have, you know, there's times when you'll get the 30 games in a row with no days off. That's when the job gets really tough. That's the part I won't miss when it's behind me. But otherwise, I mean, heck, I can't complain. That walking on a major league field every night, every little boy's dream, right? And I get to do that, and I've done it for a long time. I worked my 2000th major league game last year, and it's gone by very fast. I mean, I think you guys are probably around the same age as me. As you start hitting near 50 and you look back, and it seems like it went by in a flash.
Brian, how does a guy get from Helena, Montana to Major League Baseball as an umpire? I know a lot of folks are familiar with kind of the progression that a player would take. I mean, to a point, some faster than others, but we're at least familiar with minor league baseball. We're familiar with college baseball. We're familiar with things like that, especially, you know, formerly used to have a minor league team in town. But as an umpire, I don't think anybody knows really the path that an umpire takes to get to where you're at.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate to grow up in Helena. Always, during my time in Helena, we always had a minor league team. It was the Phillies when I was a kid. It was the Gold Sox, and then it was the Brewers. My father, Jim Knight, had a passion for umpiring and umpires for some reason. He went to umpire school, one of the professional schools, when I was 6 years old. And when he came back from that, he started umpiring everything, you know, the Legion baseball. He got into some college stuff, not in Montana, but in the region, women's fast pitch softball, Little League, whatever. I mean, and then they started using him as an alternate in the Pioneer League for the Brewers games and the, you know, the Gold Sox games. And so as a kid going to Kendrick Legion Field every night of the summer, it felt like being around that kind of part of baseball, seeing a different side of it. And as I got older, you know, he would bring the Pioneer League umpires over to the house and get them out of the hotel and feed them dinner. And these are guys starting their careers, some of which I, you know, still work with to this day, guys I met when I was 18 years old that would come over and hang out with us. And so having the team there, having the professional team there, having a father that was passionate about this stuff and meeting a lot of the guys that were living it, kind of put it all in the, at least in the, if not in the front of my mind, in the back of my mind when I was getting ready to graduate from Capitol High. I went off to college in Kansas City, strangely enough, on a clarinet scholarship.
What? Yeah. I didn't know that was a thing.
I didn't either.
Yeah, I didn't either. one of my biggest influences in my high school life was our band director, Larry Nielsen at Capitol High. And he's like, "You're going to college. Why don't you try to get a scholarship?" I'm like, "Okay." So he set up a little recorder and I played my little clarinet thing. And he sent the tape off to this college in Missouri. And I was already going to the college, William Jewell College in Liberty, Missouri, which is in the Kansas City area. Go Chiefs. And they gave me a $500 scholarship, believe it or not. I have it hanging next to my umpire school diploma.
Jeez, Brian, I mean, you're telling that to everybody. If Chris Bryant happens to listen to this, the next time you eject him, he's going to bring up the clarinet thing. You've kind of brought that upon yourself.
I'm very proud of my clarinet history.
Were you
I want to make band cool again, man. Come on.
You may have buried the headline there a little bit. Your umpire school diploma? Is that? I didn't know that was a thing either. It never occurred to me that there's an academic. Like, what do you got to do? What is umpire school? Walk me through that.
So to become a professional umpire and a major league umpire, you have to go to one of the, now there's two schools, but there used to be three professional umpire schools that are feeders into the minor leagues. And that's the only way, like you can't get to the major leagues by just working up through the college ranks. You have to go to one of these schools. They do the placements into the minor leagues. And so after that 1 year of college, I didn't really know what to do. I went from a pretty good student in high school to not such a great student in college and a little bit aimless. And dad said, well, instead of spending $20,000 at college next year, why don't you go to umpire school? And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, give it a shot. If it works out, great. If it doesn't, then you find something else. You'll figure it out. And I'm like, okay. And he offered to pay for it. And he sent me down to the school. All the schools are in Florida and they're all in January. And they all run at the same time. And so I went to the school and it's a 5-week basic crash course in how to be a professional umpire. Anybody could go down there. And by the end of the 5 weeks, you'll know how to go out and umpire a baseball game. That's how good these schools are. And it's 7 days a week for 5 or 6 weeks. And so out of these schools, they take their top 10 students, approximately, offer them jobs in the minor leagues. The year I went to school, out of the three schools, I think there was around 320 students total. And 36 of us got into the minor leagues out of that. And three of us made it to the major leagues. So that's kind of how the whole system works. It's changed a little bit in the years since. Major League Baseball actually runs the minor leagues now. That happened, I think, in 2020 or 2021. And they have their own umpire school now. And so it's a little bit different. I'm not really sure how it works these days, to be honest, because this was such a long time ago. But yeah, that's the basics.
And does Major League Baseball running the minor leagues make it better or worse from your point of view?
That's a good question. I'm not around the minor leagues much anymore, and I don't really even know any minor league umpires anymore, except for the ones that come and join our crew during the season to fill in for, you know, they pull guys from AAA up to fill in for our guys that are injured or if we have a little vacation time, because we do get some time off during the season where we can go home and kind of regroup, and they use the minor leagues to fill in, and that's how I got my start. But as far as how it's going now, it seems like it's probably better, but I don't really know. That's a great question.
Now, Brian, obviously, with Major League Baseball and being an ump for as long as you have, there's got to be some. I mean, you were just you were an ump for the World Series. Just the most memorable times for you, like memorable plays, memorable games, memorable. I mean, your first time stepping on the field. Just a little bit on a retrospective of your career, about some of the highlights and some of the things that you've experienced that absolutely really put a mark in you that you'll never forget.
There's really a lot of them. I'll try to think of a couple, but you know, obviously the first game I worked, that's one that'll stand out for forever. I was working in the Pacific Coast League in AAA, and I was sitting in my hotel room in Des Moines, Iowa, getting ready to go work the Iowa Cubs, you know, and the phone rang, and it was one of our guys from Major League Baseball, one of our supervisors, and he's like, "Hey, what time's your game tomorrow?" And I'm like, "Well, I think it's at 7:00," and he goes, "Nope, you're working 1:00 tomorrow in Arlington, Texas." That's kind of how he did it. And I'm like, "Oh, okay. That's awesome." So I go down, I fly from Des Moines to Arlington, you know, to Dallas. And it just so happened that my dear departed grandmother happened to be in town, yeah, visiting her sister. And it was a makeup game between the Rangers and the White Sox. I think they had got rained out the night before, and they had to kind of cobble a crew together for the makeup game on a Monday. This is an enormous stadium, the old stadium in Arlington. And I bet you there was 2,000 people there, maybe. It was pretty memorable being in this giant stadium, really, really nervous, obviously, with only 2,000 people there to watch, one of them being my grandma sitting in the front row right next to me. And the home plate umpire that day, Wally Bell, who also has sadly departed, he walked over to where she was sitting in between innings and gave her a baseball. And, you know, that was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening. You know, I'm in the big leagues. Wow. That was the start. And then through the years, I got to experience, you know, I went up and down from AAA to the big leagues for 10 seasons. And I worked almost 800 games, I think 700 to 800 games before I got hired full time. I'll never forget my first game at Fenway Park. It was a May 2008 or 9. I'm sitting there in Boston in my hotel room and I have the plate that night. I'm the plate umpire that night. And I am very, very anxious, to say the least. Fenway Park, you know, growing up in Montana, these things only exist in your television a lot of the time. So I was sitting in my hotel room thinking, I'm going to go work home plate in Fenway Park. I'm scared to death. One of my mentors at the time called me like randomly and he said, "Hey, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm doing all right." He goes, "I know you're at Fenway Park tonight. I just want to let you know, it's the same game, brighter lights, bigger crowd. You're gonna be great. Just try to relax." I'm like, okay. And so I go out there that night, and I'm working the game. John Lester's pitching for the Red Sox, and they're playing the Royals. He's got a no-hitter going, and it keeps going, and it keeps going, and it keeps going. And now it's the top of the ninth, and he still has a no-hitter going. I'm going, what the? This is crazy. Thank God. Thank God he struck out the last batter swinging. I didn't really have to do much in that game. I didn't have to, there was no controversy on the bases. You know, back in those days, we didn't have replay. And, you know, we were still a year away from the Jim Joyce play at first base.
I wanted to ask yeah, about that. I'm a Tigers fan.
Yeah, we're a year or two away from that happening. Woo. We're 5 or 6 years away from having instant replay even. So it was when the game ended, when the batter swung and missed at strike three to end the game, I almost collapsed. I mean,
no one thinks of the pressure on the ump during a no hitter. I mean, especially with replay and all the things that go into it now.
Yeah. So walking off the field, it's kind of a long walk in Fenway from the field to the locker room. And I just sat down and I don't think I got back up for maybe an hour. I was shaking. You know, I was fine during the game. It's when it ended that everything kind of poured out of me, but that's one experience I'll never forget. And then, you know, I had the opportunity to work another no-hitter a few years later behind the plate. It was Josh Beckett when he was playing for the Dodgers. Those moments are really special. Working the All-Star game in Kansas City in 2012 was definitely a highlight, having family and friends and being a part of that. You know, having gone to school in that area, I had some family that lived there. They moved from Montana. My uncles moved from Montana to Kansas City in the late 80s. And that was kind of one of the reasons I went down there. I was really close to them. And sadly, all of them have now left us. But at the time, you know, most of them were still around and got to really enjoy a fun All-Star game back in those days. And it was Mike Trout's first All-Star game. It was Bryce Harper's first All-Star game. It was really cool to be a part of that.
I was at ESPN in Omaha in 2012, and we were working closely with the Storm Chasers at the time, which were an affiliate with KC. And I've told Scott lots of times, I'm like, it's one of those places in flyover country you really should see, that, especially for baseball. And then the Royals in that year with that All-Star game was pretty special.
You're right. I mean, go to Arrowhead Stadium on a Sunday and you'll see. I mean, it's – and the baseball, when the team is good, it's – plus, beautiful stadiums. I mean, Kauffman Field in Kansas City is just beautiful with the fountains and everything. It's just a gorgeous place to be. I worked in Omaha, too, you know, the Pacific Coast League. They were the Omaha Royals back in those days.
Again, it's little Kansas City. I liked Omaha. I get a lot of weird look. When people hear me say that, I'm like, they got the great people. There's a killer food scene there. The little downtown right on the river is neat. And people always look at me sideways like, it's in Nebraska. I'm like, I know, but Omaha's pretty neat.
Yeah, Omaha's cool. I have vague memories of it. We worked at the old stadium, the college stadium. I understand they have a brand new, well, I guess it's not brand new anymore, but after I left the Pacific Coast League, I know they built a brand new stadium. And yeah. All those little league towns are cool, man. They all have a little character, and there's something good about all of them.
Yeah, I was there for the first year in the new place right after they closed Rosenblatt. Which is still just to see. Again, baseball is just such an interesting sport from that perspective, because aside from maybe Lambeau Field in the NFL, there's no real comparison to so many of those little stadiums that are just kind of squirreled away in these neighborhoods, in these towns and cities across the country that will sneak right up on you. Everything now is so very corporate, especially at the highest levels. And I know that was a special place for a lot of people.
Yeah, when I was in Double A in the Southern League, Chattanooga was one of those places, and I worked the last ever game at their old stadium, and like Babe Ruth had played on that field. It's crazy. Like, you're right. Baseball has a rich history all around the country. I'm still heartbroken that Helena lost their team, because Kendrick Legion Field is, you know, that was my home away from home for most of my young life. And it had such an influence on me being where I'm at today that it makes me sad that kids in Helena right now aren't able to experience the professional baseball scene. I think it's really bad.
Well, you're talking to the reason why, because Scott waged a one-man scorched earth campaign to get them run out of town because he was mad at the mascot.
I thought the mascot was dumb, but that had nothing to do with baseball team.
Why isn't it a thing? He was obviously the old man gets ginned up about some silly stuff, and he was mad about that mascot for years.
The mascot was a dinosaur, and the team was called the Brewers. It didn't make any sense.
So yeah, that was.
He's still mad.
Now, Brian, the one thing about you, and I brought it up as kind of a joke a little bit, but here's the thing about umpires. There's two things about them. First of all, if nobody knows your name and knows who you are, that's a better thing. So anonymity and not being a person like everybody brings up Angel Hernandez as an example for baseball fans to hate on. But when you Google your name, you also bring up your worst moments, not your best. If you Google Brian Knight because, you know, you want to see what he's done in his long career, you bring up things like kicking out Chris Bryant. You bring out things like your missed calls. You bring out getting hit in the face by a 96-mile-an-hour fastball. That's a unique job when you get the worst of you is coming up to the top of the attention.
Chris Bryant deserved that, by the way. I mean, come on.
He usually does. No.
He was like 0-for-12 in that series. And he's a great guy. I was a little surprised that he. But everybody reaches their point, and it had nothing to do with me. I know that. So, yeah, the Google stuff and the social media. I don't have any social media.
Oh, I
dropped all that 5 or 6 years ago. For that very reason, like, there's nothing good to come out of that. And Googling yourself is dangerous, no matter who you are, but especially if you're an umpire. So. I try to avoid that at all costs, but you know, you still get the friend and family member that'll send you along some stuff.
They're not your friends. That's not your friend.
It depends on what they're sending, right? I've been fortunate. I haven't had too many terrible things happen on the field where I've drawn a lot of attention to myself. I have been hit in the head a lot, and that's, you know, it's gonna be an issue as I get older, but I've already had one neck surgery, and I'm looking at probably having another one in the next year or two. So
one of the aspects of that, Brian, is that one of the aspects of that is that your job performance is also very public. There's a scorecard. There's literally a Twitter account called Umpire Scorecards, and there's a review and a grading and everything. I mean, it's so scrutinized nowadays that it's to the point where fans can see a percentage of your strikes calls. And I mean, it's just crazy the where we are now in the kind of the microscope that's put on your job.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that gets sent to me quite a bit from friends and stuff. Like, hey, here's your score from last night. Well, we have an official score. You know, we have our own system where I log in and I know exactly what happened. Plus, I was there, so I saw it the first time too. But yeah, I guess that's just, you know, kind of the day and age we're living in right now, where there's no hiding from that kind of stuff. I mean, when I first started working in the major leagues in 2001, you'd go to a stadium and the cameras would be covered in tarps and you'd be like, oh, great. No TV today. Can you imagine that happening now?
No.
And so that's all ramped up to a point where, yeah, it's really hard on our guys. I've been pretty good about staying away and I haven't let it really affect me. I'd be lying if I said that has never affected me. Yeah, I mean, you know, you see some stuff out there that hurts, and usually it's not true. And these third-party strike zone websites, it's really hard on some of our guys. And again, one of the reasons why I don't even have social media anymore, I have no interest in it. We get a thorough evaluation of every game on the bases and on the plate. And our average as a staff last year, according to Major League Baseball's official statistics that they provide for us, was 97.6%, I believe, on the plate last year. So you kind of got to be able to take the online stuff with a little bit of a grain of salt. You're not going to call a pitch a strike when the catcher doesn't catch it.
And right.
The third party websites don't know that, you know.
How do you best prepare for that? Because, you know, as you're talking about the game, and again, I go back to, you know, Jim Joyce after the imperfect game with Galarraga, and the way it affected him is the memory that I carry from that. I was watching that game like every other Tigers fan, because pretty soon by the seventh, eighth inning, people were making calls like, hey, man, you got to turn on the game. So everybody's watching. And Joyce the next night when Galarraga brought him the ball out to the mound, and he addressed the media, which happens pretty rarely, and he was choked up about it and copped to it and owned it. And so you've got to be prepared on the tactical side to know what the hell you're doing as an ump on the one hand, but how do you prepare psychologically? Do you just have a therapist on retainer? I mean, how does that work? Because, you know, the emotional side of your job is a real thing.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a huge thing. We have a lot of resources now through Major League Baseball. If you are needing help in those areas, you know, I felt so bad for Jimmy when that happened. You know, he's a friend of mine, you know, and I worked a lot with him during those days, and he went through what is every umpire's worst nightmare, right? I mean, to see him come out the other end like he did was a little inspirational, actually. Now he's doing commercials with Ken Griffey Jr., you know.
Right.
It all turned out okay. But yeah, it's very hard. I had just from my own personal experience, I had a call in Toronto quite a few years ago. Again, before replay could have fixed this call in about half a minute. I called a runner trying to get to second base, trying to stretch a single into a double. I called him out at second base in a big spot in the game. Was a player for the Mets, and they were playing in Toronto. Called him out, kind of killed a rally. They ended up losing the game. It was, you know, kind of an important game at the time for pennant race stuff. And, you know, it didn't take me long to realize that I had missed the call. I was just blocked out. It was as simple as that. You know, I had to guess, and I guessed wrong, and there was no way to fix it at that time. So walking off the field, you know, getting in the locker room and going through the next 24 hours of probably the lowest I've ever been in my life, knowing that not only did I screw it up, but I have a whole fan base that pretty much hates me. Scared to death because tomorrow I got to go work first base with the same teams. They're not going to be too happy with me. So every little thing I do the next day is going to be under a microscope as far as they're concerned. And you tend to start blowing these things out of proportion a little bit, right? Because you guys probably don't even know what I'm talking about. I don't know if it made SportsCenter that night or not even. But yeah, it's a very, very mentally tough thing to do. And it's not for the faint of heart. You have to be able to try to deal with some of these stresses and anxieties in healthy ways. Well, that was a rough patch. And the next day, you know, the game went fine. At the plate meeting, Terry Collins was the manager for the Mets, and he brought the lineup cards out, and I was going, oh God, is he going to come out and give me some more grief? But he was awesome. I engaged him in conversation when he came out, and I said, hey, Terry, you know, and he goes, stop right there. He goes, you did nothing wrong. Don't worry about it. It's over. And gave me a little hug, and I'm like, Oh, okay. We're good. Yeah.
Well, the scrutiny on umpires in Major League Baseball, it's different than any other sport and than any other officials. And it also leads to a lot more about, fans can see personalities in umpires, styles in umpires, and mostly on home plate, but it also carries into other jobs because you guys rotate around the field. But with that, I mean, you kind of develop your own kind of, your own knowledge as a fan of each umpire, and the ones, like I said, the ones who are more anonymous are the ones who are probably doing the best job. But what is your particular, like, for instance, like when a manager comes out of the dugout and he's ready to have an argument with you, what is your stance on that? How does that work for somebody who's not familiar with the game? I know there's certain things you don't say or they're going to get you tossed. There's certain phrases, certain stances, there's certain posturing that takes place. All of those things, where do you kind of feel like when somebody's coming out at you, what are your thoughts on that?
It's changed, you know, over the course of my career, because now I have a lot of experience and a lot of years behind me. Usually when the manager comes out now, I had him as a player. And so we've known each other for long enough to know that this is going to be how this conversation is going to go. And it's usually fine. I'm not too worried about it. I know how to handle managers way better now than I did, you know, 23 years ago when I first started this. But back early in my career, and really managers don't come out and argue much anymore. Instant replay kind of took a lot of the fun out of that. It just doesn't happen. I mean, it's all balls and strikes now, and it's usually from a distance, and somebody yells and you throw them out and they leave. And there's really not too much face-to-face confrontation anymore. Back in the day, however, you know, when I was a young 26-year-old man working in Atlanta and Bobby Cox is running out to me, that was a little bit of a different story. My approach has always been to not add fuel to the fire. Don't be the aggressor in any of these. Let them, it's kind of an old umpire saying, like, let them throw themselves out. You know, don't bait them. Don't do things that escalate the situation. And that's kind of how I've worked through my whole career, is take them as they come, listen, and if they're the aggressor, match their aggression or their intensity, but don't take it to the next level. Let them do that.
There's times when you
really don't want to, and but.
Well, there's a difference in dealing with one manager to another. Some of them, I mean, you can watch the difference, again, you know, as a fan, and going through some of the classics back in the day, there was, Earl Weaver, Billy Martin, the guys who were known for getting out there and getting real, they're real hotheads. And then you got other guys, you know, Bud Black for the Rockies doesn't do a lot of that. But it's got to be, when you're young, a little bit intimidating.
Oh, man. I mean, I had, Bobby Cox. I mean, Lou Piniella.
Right.
Some of these guys. Back when I was first starting, you know, I can't even remember some of them now, like the Grady Littles, the Terry Collins. It's really intimidating. But then you start realizing that Major League Baseball is entertainment. And part of the entertainment for the fans, especially back in those days, was the interaction. I mean, you go on YouTube and look at Earl Weaver yelling at umpires. It's awesome. I do it all the time. It's hilarious. And so you kind of got to have the perspective on it, too, that it's, you know, we're playing a game out here. This isn't life or death. and the fans really like seeing that. And I'm kind of sad that it's gone away, especially now because I have a little more tenure. I think I'd be really a lot better at it than I was back then, but I don't have the chance anymore because they don't come out and argue because we go put our headsets on and figure out what the right call is. And I think the fans loved it so much. I think it's much missed. You know, I think we live in a kind of an era now where everything has to be so precise and so perfect.
Well, and certainly as a fan, I mean, I get amped up the same way anybody does. You see somebody come out of the dugout, but secretly in the back of my head, and certainly this is what would keep me from being an umpire, I am waiting for an ump to just slap the taste out of somebody's mouth when they get a little too close, get a little too animated. You know, like, I've had enough, bitch, bam, and then just, like, give them the business. Obviously, that kind of stuff doesn't happen, but man, oh, man, I don't know how it doesn't happen because when guys come out and come after you guys – I don't need to be a lip reader to know what's coming out of a lot of those mouths.
Yeah. Well, and we have to be accountable to Major League Baseball. I mean, we have to conduct ourselves a certain way that the managers and players sometimes aren't held to that same standard.
Right.
But in the minor leagues, you know, in the Pioneer League in 1995, I had the general manager of the Ogden team. I think it was the Ogden Raptors.
Mm-hmm.
Our locker room was a trailer, and he barged in, tried to fight me. I had to throw my chest protector at him to keep him away from me. I mean, I had a player in AAA fire a baseball at me as hard as he could. Yeah, I mean,
but he missed. That's why he's in AAA still.
Exactly. Yeah. Ball outside.
Oh, that'd be the best.
So that was the Wild West back then, you know. It's pretty tame nowadays by comparison, for sure. And like I said, a lot of the managers now I had as players. And so Aaron Boone, I had him as a player. Craig Counsell had him as a player. I mean, there's only so much you can say to a guy that you've known for 20 years. I mean,
now, Brian, you were mentioning that part of baseball has changed a little bit. There's been changes in baseball recently. What they're trying to do a lot of times now is get viewership and attendance back. In your opinion, first of all, why has it declined as far as what you see at a ballpark being there, you know, for as many games as you do? And also, what is kind of the cure, and is it working what they're doing right now with speeding up the game and those aspects?
Yeah, I think they've done a fantastic job. And I was a little skeptical at first with the new pitch clock, but I'm a believer. I'm sold. And in fact, we're changing it to 2 seconds shorter this year. Oof. With runners on base. It's going from 20 to 18 seconds. Their goal is to get game times to 2 hours and 30 minutes. And last year we were able to go to 2 hours and 40 minutes. And so they believe by adjusting the clock just a little bit more, they can get that closer to the goal of 2:30. And really that's what the fans want. I mean, everything we're doing right now is for the fans. They poll the fans extensively, and overwhelmingly the fans want faster games. They don't want to sit in the ballpark for 3 hours and 45 minutes. And I think the proof is in the pudding now with 1 year under our belt. And I think everybody at first was a little nervous that the clock's, it's going to cause chaotic situations on the field. And there was growing pains a little bit in April and May, but in our 5 games of the World Series, we had no clock violations. The whole postseason, I think there was only 2. And so, as always in baseball, the players, the managers, the umpires, we adapt pretty quickly as long as we're told how to do it and explained how it works. And we were trained very well. And it was all a last second thing. I mean, and our staff of 76 umpires did such a great job of enforcing very complicated clock rules, really add a ton of what we do on the field. I mean, not only are you worried about the pitch coming in, but you're worried about how much time's left on the clock. And you got to start thinking about things like, okay, if the batter calls timeout right now, what do I do? If the pitcher steps off the rubber with nobody on base, what happens? We depend a lot on the clock operators that do a fantastic job hitting the right button, making sure you have a close play at first base. Okay, the manager has 15 seconds to challenge the call. So like, the game's faster, but we're doing the same amount of work even more in a less period of time. So it was really interesting to see. And I think it took me, I don't know, a month to get comfortable with it. You know, going back to spring training in a couple of weeks, it'll be interesting to get back into it. And it's just a, on the field, it's such an accelerated game now. It feels so fast on the field when you're used to doing one thing one way for so long. And then all of a sudden, and I think they're really smart about how they come up with this stuff. There's a group of people in Major League Baseball that come up with these. They do all the studies. They test it in the minor leagues, and they know how much time they're going to drop off an average game time. And it's incredible. Like, they're so smart.
Well, as a fan, I've enjoyed the, especially the speeding up of games. I watch I watch a lot of Colorado Rockies games every year. And I don't know if that's a form of self-punishment or if I just can't turn my head away from a car wreck. But either way, I can now watch Rockies games and get to bed at a decent hour, which is unless it's on the West Coast. But I mean, that sort of a thing, once you get used to it, I think it's a lot of the ideas, and baseball is a game where people love, they love tradition. They love the way the game used to be. There's a change is a really hard thing for Major League Baseball. And the fans usually buck up against almost everything, but this change, I think, is and it's good to hear you are a fan of it, because I think it's going to be overall well accepted as far as those changes go, especially ones to speed the game up.
Well, now that I know you're a Rockies fan, I know why you keep bringing up that Bryant situation. So.
There are some fans who think you should have kicked him out of Colorado altogether, but
he's a great guy. And your boy Todd Helton just got in the Hall of Fame. Oh. I really enjoyed being around him. He was really fun to stand next to, you know, working first base all those years next to him. He was a really interesting fella and very talented, obviously. But anyways, yeah, I mean, you can see it in the ballparks. The crowds are more into the game. I think as a fan, if I was a fan of baseball, I would really enjoy it too. I mean, we got some new rules coming down the line this spring that I think will improve the game also. They're slight tweaks. Points of emphasis, more or less. You know, guys are not going to be allowed to block bases with their legs and feet anymore. Wow. For second and third base. Kind of crack down on that because players are injuring themselves, and it's kind of an unfair advantage. So there's going to be an effort this spring, starting in a couple of weeks, to crack down on those types of plays and call them as obstruction and kind of clean that up. We're really good at cleaning things up. I think baseball got to a point where every night that you walked on the field, you knew you were going to be out there for 3.5 hours. And it was, especially like 2021, 22, you just kind of almost dreaded going to the ballpark for that reason. And I think the fans probably felt the same way. Now, when I'm getting ready to leave my hotel room at 5 o'clock to go to the stadium, I have this sense of like, put a little pep in everybody's step. You know, I'm only going to be on the field for 2.5 hours. That extra half an hour over the course of 100 games, we're talking like 80 or 90 hours a season less for us on our feet. So yeah, it's more work in the moment, but the long-term benefits are phenomenal.
Well, we all hope that the attendance and viewership can go up because of that. So I think that's what all fans are looking for as well.
Yeah. We want to grow the game. We need to, it's important that we maintain our status as America's pastime, right? I know football's the big dog in town right now, but baseball's important, and we need to keep up and get people watching and get kids playing and keep people interested in it.
Well, Brian, your passion for the game is evident, man. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. It's an interesting conversation. And again, as we look out the window at the snow piling up, we've added about a half an inch while we've been talking to you here. So we're looking forward to seeing games in warm places and green grass. And thank you so much for the time.
Yeah, I'm going to pop up to – we're building – my mom's building a house up outside of Canyon Prairie Lake there. Hopefully breaking ground this spring, so I'll pop in and see you guys in March after spring training.
Oh, that would be great.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Please do.
Yeah, I miss it up there. I really do, and I look forward to having a place to go again. So
that's
we'll
awesome.
See you then.
Yeah, that's awesome, Brian. Thank you so much, buddy. We really appreciate it.
Yep, thank you guys.
That's it. That's our show. Thank you so much for your time. Please, again, subscribe, rate, and review the show. That is how we get to do what we do, and we will be back next week.